You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Now to a topic I followed for years, the threat to world food production from an unstable climate. We're already seeing it, and the future has worse to come. We've all got that sinking feeling climate change could mean food shortages in coming decades, but we really don't know how or how much. An international team of scientists has plowed through vast numbers of studies trying to add up what we know. They've published a first look at their findings in the journal Nature Climate Change. At the University of Leeds, where he teaches climate impacts, we've reached the lead author, Dr. A.J. Challenor. Andy Challenor, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much.
Well, I'd like to begin with a couple of broad assumptions that we've come to accept about the future of food in this warming world. The first is a huge generality, and before we get to the detailed results of your study, can we say that climate change will probably reduce future food production?
I think that climate change will have effects that are different in different places, and climate change will have an effect on the year-to-year variability of production. But taken on average, with an aggregate look at what we expect for agriculture, including the fact that we know that some regions will benefit, we can say that actually most regions are going to have to adapt if we're going to keep yields high.
Good. Now, food experts, including Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute, have used a maxim for every degree of warming, world food production would be reduced by 10%. Well, now we've really studied it. Does that hold up in your meta-analysis?
Yeah, I think this is exactly the issue I was just talking about, where we're taking average yields and saying what's going to happen on average across the whole globe. You know, there's so many different agricultural systems that we're averaging across, and there are a number of different figures that you can come up with. This particular study, we didn't produce a kind of central figure for a percent reduction per year, but, you know, we certainly showed that we can expect 5 to 10% drop in the 2030s, maybe a bit more, in fact, than that in some places and times. And then later in the century, decreases of more than 25% will become increasingly common. So that's more or less, I think, consistent with the figure you just cited.
So how does your new paper compare to the previous AR4 report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change? And will it be part of the new fifth assessment report coming out this year?
Yeah, so the fifth assessment report, as you may know, comes out in a week or two. And I'm one of the authors on that study, so this study certainly feeds directly into that. I can't really comment on the study, on the IPCC assessment itself, but at the moment. But in terms of the differences between our study that's just been published and AR4, for example, in AR4 it was shown or believed that from the model results that 1 or 2 degrees of warming in temperate regions would be something that, you know, more or less would be able, our agricultural systems would be able to cope with, and in fact that yields may even go up a little bit. What we've found is that on average that's not true. And again, that phrase on average is important, but still, on average yields are more likely to go down for a degree or two of warming than to go up.
So before we get to conclusions, there are serious reservations about gaping holes in our data and our methods of collection. And this isn't a criticism of your work. Your team raised these problems over and over again in this latest letter in the journal Nature Climate Change. And I want to just take one example. Previous crop predictions, including those used in your summary analysis, assume there will be enough water for crops in the coming decades and after 2050. But California is already in a drought, and major wheat areas in Russia and Australia were hit by drought in the last 5 years. India and China may be approaching limits to what they can pump out of the ground. Can we really assume there will be the water we need in this future hotter world?
Yeah, so that assumption about water is very important. It applies, of course, to irrigation. There are rain-fed crops, and obviously the simulations take account of the changes in rainfall that we expect with climate change. So really, there's no big issue there to do with water availability or not taking account of water availability. However, when people conduct simulations that say, okay, what happens with irrigation, that's where people make that assumption. Well, quite naturally, it's a necessary assumption to conduct the modeling, is to say, well, if we had sufficient water for irrigation, what would the yields be? And you know, one of the future challenges for this area of research that I think we're starting to see in the literature, we're starting to see scientists do, is to look at that water availability using the information that we have about future water and rainfall, and say, well, is that water going to be available for irrigation? And if it isn't, then the OWS irrigation simulations need to say, well, we'd like to add more water than this, but we can't because the water simply isn't, you know, we don't think the water will be available. So, you know, I think that's an area where already we're seeing the science improving, but it's definitely something that at the moment we recognise where there are simulations to do with irrigation that, you know, it does make that assumption, and that may not necessarily hold, as you say, in particular regions, California being an example.
And then we have the problems in the micro world. Do we really know how pests and plant diseases might change in the warming decades ahead?
Again, that's something that's emerging, but very difficult to do comprehensively, to say every pest that might affect every crop, every disease that might affect every crop, and how it will change, how that pathogen, for example, will change under climate change, and then saying, well, how will that match up and how will that impact on crop yield? So, you know, that's a very big area, really, for understanding. There are lots of people working on that for particular crops, for particular locations, but synthesizing an overall summary in the way that we have in our paper, an overall summary that includes pests and diseases, is very difficult simply because of the sheer number of different pests and diseases that exist and the interactions that they have with the crop.
And Andy, you've raised the problem of assuming a mean pattern of growth versus possible weather extremes, as we're already seeing in North America and the UK and elsewhere. Could you talk to us about that? Why is that important?
Yeah, I mean, it's very important. So it's something that we're seeing in the US and in the UK, as you say. It's something that is beginning to be attributed to climate change. That's not something we tackle in our paper, but that's a sort of comment on the broader literature. What we do in the paper is look at what we expect in the future with regard to year-to-year variability. And what we see is that drought and heat stress do mean, and sort of the irregular pattern of drought and heat stress do mean that the year-to-year variability in crop yield will increase. And we've already seen where there are years of low production because of heat stress events, say in Russia, we've seen this with wheat, and also in Australia. There have been subsequent food price rises that aren't necessarily related one-to-one with those production decreases, but nonetheless, there's an interaction and a relationship there. So there could be implications there for food prices, and certainly, you know, stability of our food production is very important. We need to know that there will be enough food in any given year. So that year-to-year variability really is a key issue.
Despite these variables, your team did manage to assess what we know about our human future in agriculture, and it seems to depend on where we live. Why don't we start with the three biggest food crops in the temperate zones where most of my listeners are? What can we predict so far?
So on average, as I say, let's start with wheat. Then for temperate regions, as I say, even 1 to 2 degrees of warming, and certainly more than that, will reduce yields on average. But of course, you know, there will be within that there's a range, and that range includes increases. So, you know, there will be regions where yields will increase. And, you know, there's a similar pattern for maize or corn, where maybe less clear that there will be increases in yield with maize than is the case for wheat. But again, the challenge there becomes taking advantage of adapting to where there are challenges, but also taking advantage of that potential for increases in yield.
And it seems like every chart shows a decline of food production in the tropics where billions of people live. Why is that?
Yeah, so tropical regions already are essentially growing crops at higher temperatures than we are in temperate regions. They're very dependent on rain-fed agriculture. They're dependent on monsoon systems, so disruptions to that cause problems. So it's a combination of those things, really. Being already at temperatures that are quite high means that adding more to that begins to cause problems, you know, sooner than it does for temperate regions.
Again, Lester Brown has said that rice is already, at least the varieties we have now, is already pretty close to its peak warming limits, and a 1 or 2 degree rise could have very fundamental effects for people who depend on rice for their diets.
Yeah, absolutely. Rice is a hugely important crop, and again, is another crop that without adaptation we expect yields to decrease on average in most of rice is in tropical regions, but there were a handful of data for temperate regions that show a similar effect.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Andy Challenor from the University of Leeds. Existing studies of the impact of climate change on agriculture assume we'll make incremental changes to keep food growing. What are some of the adaptations we can expect to see?
So early on, by early on I mean a sort of 1 to 2 degrees of warming or something that can begin to happen already, include a change in crop variety to a variety that might be more tolerant if we're seeing increasing drought, or, you know, perhaps a different crop, or you know, smaller changes like a change in planting date, realising that maybe warmer temperatures might mean we can plant a little earlier in temperate regions. So those are the kind of small, the relatively small adjustments that the models that we looked at in our paper can do a quite a good job of simulating and of taking account of. They're not so good at doing the sort of bigger, well, by definition, they don't do the bigger changes associated with how agriculture might look in the future or what kind of investments are needed or what kind of movements of agricultural zones are needed.
As your paper notes, humans may have to change what they grow completely if we get a lot of warming, and millions of farmers depend on traditional knowledge. Some don't have sophisticated communication skills or education. Is it realistic to think we'll be able to make large-scale changes of crops?
I think this is where the issue of planning is important. This is where there's a role for government, for agricultural extension workers, and actually for education as well. And I think it, those larger changes that are needed, there is time to plan. And I think that's very much a job for governments, maybe non-governmental organisations as well, maybe in temperate regions as well, but maybe particularly in developing countries, to begin to plan and think about that. And the science is now at a point where we can start to deliver those answers of, look, here's when we expect the major changes. It won't be a particular year or perhaps even a particular decade, but, you know, look, by the 2030s to the 2050s, we're seeing these larger changes and we need to start planning for them. So, you know, I'm optimistic about that because I think there is time and we do have the kind of infrastructure and organizations that exist in order to conduct exactly that kind of planning.
And the other end of that stick is people like to eat what they've always eaten. I'm thinking of farmers in Central America who turn to black beans as more climate tolerant than red beans, but they export most of it because local people want to eat red beans with their rice. Can science account for things like cultural bias and tradition?
Well, that would be an input to the models. If I think social science really is the area where we say, okay, let's do some surveys, produce some analysis that tells us about these very important cultural biases or preferences that people have. And then we can put that into the model and say, look, you know, people don't want to be growing this particular crop in this region. They want to be growing this other crop. How will that other crop fare? Is this going to be a sustainable pattern for food production? So I think, you know, that's an area where science, natural science plus social science can really begin to, you know, deliver some of those more nuanced answers that get to people's preferences.
And all of these difficulties take place against the backdrop of a human population growing by hundreds of thousands of people every day. From your study, are we looking at how to keep up with today's level of food production in the future, or are we looking at how to expand agriculture to match that global population of maybe 9, 10 or more billion people?
Very important question. In our study, we are looking at what is going to happen to crop yield as climate changes. And all other things being equal, crop yield is the food that's produced per unit area. It tells you about production. It doesn't tell you anything about demand. So the backdrop to the paper that we don't address within the paper is, well, you know, yes, the paper says we've got decreases in crop yield happening, but actually the situation suggested by an increasing population is worse than that simply suggested by these declines in production, because we're going to need to produce more in the future, not just the same. And within the framework of our paper, we focused really on saying, well, what if we just wanted to keep producing the same? But actually, you know, we do need to produce more in the future. We will do.
And that's even more true if people move up the food chain towards meat. We won't even go there. But what about the counter-arguments, such as increased carbon dioxide will be a benefit to the plants, a longer growing season, maybe in temperate climates, and from that, new croplands opening up places further north in Canada or Siberia? Can those benefits overcome the damage caused by warming?
There's a couple of important things in there. In a number of my answers to your questions, I've stressed and I've said, on average, this will happen to crop yield. And it's, those two words are important because you're absolutely right. In some places, in some situations, there will be new opportunities. And making the most of those new opportunities is important. Now, overall, the picture seems to be one of reducing yields and of negative impacts. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be focusing on those opportunities. And as to the question of CO2, I don't have the number in front of me, but a large number of the studies that we reviewed for this meta-analysis account for the direct effect of CO2 on crops. You know, that didn't used to be so common maybe 10 or so years ago, but it's increasingly common now because, of course, people recognize it's a real effect and we need to include it in the model. So actually, a lot of the results are, you know, in spite of that increase in CO2 and the direct effect of that on crops.
And what about the weather extremes you touched on in this latest paper? Just 2 years of drought can wipe out cattle farmers, or a single year of strange cold at the wrong time can kill off orchards, as can record-strong winds. Do you worry about the outlier events as opposed to a slowly changing mean warming?
Yeah, absolutely. This is exactly the point alluded to earlier about increases in variability, the year-to-year variation, drought events, heat stress events, meaning that we have a given year with particularly low crop yield, and we expect that year-to-year variability to increase in the future, and that poses a problem for planning and ensuring a stable food supply.
And we've had scientists recently on Radio EcoShock say problems with food are basic to society as a whole. Lack of it can lead to revolutions, wars, mass migrations, maybe even mass starvation. You must have some thoughts on a personal level of what your science means for the future.
Yeah, on a personal level. I mean, I think when one gets to that kind of question of personal reactions, my experience of talking to colleagues is it comes down to whether people are natural optimists or natural pessimists. And, you know, I stressed the importance of innovation a short while ago, and I think it's very important to take advantage of innovation. We're a very innovative species. So, you know, maybe that's part of where I come at this from. But, you know, really, the science takes you so far, as you say, and then you say, here are the evidence, here are the numbers. And you know, even amongst experts, and certainly it's a general comment about people, that people will interpret things in different ways and have more optimistic and more pessimistic views of that. I certainly think it is very important that we address the issues posed to food security by climate change, but I think that means taking a balance. I think it means being clear about where there are negative effects and planning and doing something about that, and being clear about those occasions where we think there are some benefits that we may be able to take advantage of.
I see this paper as an important step, but still an early step in this field. How do you see agricultural forecasts and climate science developing as the years progress?
I think it would be important for climate models, climate science, to provide more regionally specific information whilst retaining, while improving, in fact, accuracy. I think that's going to be something that's very important. I think we're already seeing this as well. The use of climate forecasts, weather forecasts out to a few months to say, okay, what can we expect this year? And that's very important when you think about this issue of year-to-year variability. We need to know ahead of time, is this going to be one of the good years or one of the bad years or maybe one of the average years? And so, you know, there's a lot to be done there between climate science and agricultural research and crop science to begin to put together forecasting tools to help us predict on those kind of shorter timescales as well.
As we finish up, is there anything else you would like to pass on to our listeners?
No, I don't think so. It's been a pleasure talking to you about the research, and I hope the listeners have found it interesting.
Our guest has been Andy Challenor, Professor of Climate Impacts at the School of Earth and Environment at the University of Leeds in Britain. He's the lead author of the Nature Climate Change letter titled A Meta-Analysis of Crop Yield Under Climate Change and Adaptation. It was published online March 16, 2014. You can find the links you need in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Andy, thank you for sharing this with Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.